Now we continue with our conversation with Tim Madden.
From everything you've said, is it not true the entire world economy, not just Canada and the United States, but the way it's all been arranged in our current era, is like a large casino? I used to think of it as a monopoly game where you're issued this play money, and then as long as you believe that the money is working in the game, you can play the game and have fun. And this is just a really big monopoly board called the world, and we play it with national currencies. But the way you're describing it, it's more like a casino where the house always wins, the house being the bankers, and everybody else gets to bet and maybe win temporarily, but the house wins whether you win or lose as a player. Because every time you use money, they're charging you for it, and you may get ahead if you're good at the game, but the house, which is the banking institutions and the national governmental involvement with that, is winning all the time, unless something happens sometimes and there is a collapse of some sort. That's what I'm trying to understand now. Whether this image I just put out is accurate, and then is there any chance at all that this could be reversed or switched around or corrected?
From one standpoint, if you want to look at it this way, that is in a sense the purpose of taxation. It is to tie the total debt obligations of the entire system to the national populations. And basically, they want you to work more. When the government of Canada borrows money from the banks, what they do is they go to the banks and they say, we want to borrow $100 billion. And they say, well, we don't have $100 billion, but maybe you just give us a bond for $100 billion and we'll do an audit and we'll see if we can come up with some money. And then the Bank of Canada issues a $100 billion bond to the private Royal Bank of Canada, or a syndicate of the Big Five. They come back the next day and the banks go, oh, you'll never believe it. We found $100 billion in our vault last night. Now we can issue you $100 billion of credit, but you must agree to pay us interest on it. And it is hypothecated to the general credit of the country, the general assets. Now, we talk about Canada being indebted to $500-600 billion being the federal debt. Okay, now, you got the same thing at the provincial level. You got another $500 billion. Well, and you got another $500 billion at the municipal level. So let's say, let's add it all up and we'll throw in a few extras and say that we owe a total of $2 trillion for a little country like Canada. But what is Canada worth? Canada is worth easily the $5 quadrillion that I was just talking about. What's a mountain worth? What are the Great Lakes worth? We find ourselves in possession of 1/10 of the world's land area and natural resources, yet we represent only 1/200th of the world's population. If you are approaching this planet from outer space, say in a spaceship, there is not a more desirable little piece of real estate on this planet than the Dominion of Canada. The whole thing is just a paper shell game to get us to believe that we are poor so that we accept this lie that we've been living beyond our means, we are generally lazy. We need to crush those loafers who are lying in their park, you know, without jobs and put them to work at gunpoint so that we can pay this national debt, when in fact, a high school student with a little bit of training in mathematics can state categorically that this is a shell game and that this debt is impossible to pay off. It is structurally impossible, and that they've known this for 2 centuries, and we've just keep going through the same wheel. We're on the wheel. They're just exploiting it.
So, is there a change or a strategy or something that can be done by an individual or by the society as a whole that could improve or correct this? And where does one begin?
You've got to have a general amnesty for lawyers and judges, because they are the ones who have allowed this to happen, and it is technically criminal. And it has been recognized as such for a very long time. You actually have to go back to about 1880 to show when it first happened. It's all about what are called loan fees. Now, the reason loan fees are fraudulent, they will always try to suck you into an argument over whether it's interest or not interest. Don't go there. The reason loan fees are fraudulent is because the contract or the alleged lender misrepresents cost as consideration under the contract. What they say is, look, for our own peace of mind, we are going to have to build a kind of legal cage to hold you. And as a condition of the loan, you are going to pay for the construction of that legal cage. Since it is a loan you desire, therefore, the cage is constructed for your benefit and not for ours. Okay, that's the sleight of hand that they pull on you, but it is a lie, and they have to admit under their accounting regulations that they realize that their agreement to loan does not constitute a separate or distinct service.
Can you just give a concrete example of exactly a situation like that, that there's a loan for, let's say, $50,000? Describe the way the loan is written so as to create that legal cage.
Oh, well, you'll notice you just go to your mortgage and it says, in return for the lenders agreeing to loan you $50,000, you pledge, hypothecate, surrender in perpetuity all your rights to the land and everything else. Now, that requires some legal doing. They need to check the security. Say you're using a car as collateral. Basically, you're giving them the car as a gift so that they can monetize it and give it back to you and call it a loan. And they're saying, look, be reasonable. How do we know this car is roadworthy? We need to have a mechanic check it over. But that service is being performed not for your benefit. You may get something out of it, but I'll give you an example of one that struck me as very funny and very telling of the system back when I first started doing this in the early 90s. This fellow had dropped a couple of banker boxes on me worth of his records, and he just asked, can you go through my records and see if the banks cheated me? And I, oh, all right. And so I'm going through this, and he was with the CIBC. He had a whole bunch of different loans with them and different financial relationships and certificates of deposit and GICs and just a mishmash of things. And he was at a party one night, and this local manager was at the same party in the neighborhood, and they were meeting socially. And he happened to mention to the bank manager that he had this whole mess of silver in his basement. He had been collecting ingots of silver for years and years and years. He had quite a bit of it. About 2 weeks later, in the records, there was a letter from the bank saying, we understand that you have all this silver, and we've come to the conclusion that we're going to have to demand that you deposit this silver with us for safekeeping and for a security on your lines of credit, additional security in addition to the security we've already got against it. So anyways, he took the silver to the bank, and then the next month on his monthly statements, there was a new fee added, storage fee for the silver. So the thing is that the bank wanted the silver for its own benefit, and the moment it was in its vault, it became something the bank could use in the markets and gain benefit for themselves. But the mind of the banker automatically seeks out and says to himself, well, the bank has to incur the costs of putting it up in the vault and protecting it. That's a benefit to you, therefore you ought to pay us. And the fact that we're gaining a benefit from having this silver in our possession, that's none of your business. You know, this sort of thing. Take that and multiply it a millionfold and apply it to everybody in the economy, and you come to the conclusion that there's nothing a bank does that is not done for the benefit of the bank, and yet they download it to you and claim that it is a service to you. And they do so contrary to the criminal law, and it is all orchestrated by the lawyers.
So now back to the discussion of the loan fees and the strategies and the remedies of how one can turn this around, if one can, in fact, even do that.
Well, you have to do it collectively again. If you try and do it on a one-to-one basis, it's very difficult. Parliament made it illegal. This is the subject of my 1995 book. I wrote a book called Interest, Courts, and the Law. And it's a historical examination of the relationship between the courts and the financial system over the years. And I started in 1880 with this first law against front-loading, or adding interest in advance in the form of loan fees and compounding it from day one. And Parliament made it illegal 12 times over the ensuing 100 years to 1980. Finally, in 1939, the members of Parliament got so fed up, and you have to read the debates in the House of Commons, and they're bantering back and forth and saying, now it's the lawyers and all this. They simply refused to apply the law. Every time it would go to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the court would say, well, those words can't possibly mean what they appear to mean, because if they did, then the lawyer couldn't hide his fees as part of the principal sum. Therefore, go back to square one and make a new law. And that would take 20 years to get to the Supreme Court, and they'd do it again. Now, in 1939, they added what's called a preamble, and it was called the Small Loans Act of 1939, and it starts off, whereas it has become the common practice of money lenders to make charges claimed as discount, expenses, deductions for this, that, and the other thing, which are in truth and in substance interest charges and done for their benefit and not the benefit of the borrowers, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, be it enacted that no such cost shall be added or taken or deducted or received in advance. And they spelled it out in no uncertain terms. Now, legally, a preamble is a statement of the common law recognition of an evil in society that the law is intended to prevent. And the courts are required by law to recognize it and apply it. And that's why they went to the bother of adding this express thing. Now, in 1980, they were desperate to get rid of the Small Loans Act because it spelled out the evil nature of loan fees and because they wanted to jack up interest rates on credit cards to gain liquidity. It restricted them to about 0.5% per month and maybe 1%, and it was a graduated system. But they were desperate to get rid of it, but it was tied to the enactment of a criminal provision, and they couldn't get rid of one without enacting the other, and there was no time to send it back to the Commons to sort of separate the two pieces of legislation. And so they rammed it through all three readings of the House of Commons over the last 2 days of the session in the summer of 1980 without debate, and it went on to the Senate, and their Senate Banking Committee spent 3 months examining this thing, and there's about 200 pages of transcripts, and it's really amazing what they're talking about. They placed a criminal threshold on the rate at which you could convert interest into principal. If you add interest in advance, you are converting it at an infinite and therefore criminal rate. And this came up before the Senate. They said, well, what about a standby fee, Senator? Surely the rate of interest being infinite is above 60%. Could not the bank be charged with receiving interest at a criminal rate? And the answer was theoretically, yes, Senator. That's why this section of the code is unusual in that it requires the express permission of the Attorney General in order for a criminal proceeding to be initiated. Now, what they overlooked, genius ex-bankers that were sitting on the Senate Banking Committee, was that if your provision is technically criminal, then it doesn't matter that the Attorney General refuses to prosecute. The paper itself becomes unenforceable in a civil court. The banks don't have a leg to stand on, and they know it. And this was the subject of many articles that came up in these specialized publications like Canadian Banker Law Review. They treated it as an anomaly, some kind of bizarre problem that would only arise once in a while. And ever since then, they've just been going crazy. They've been one decision by the courts after another, just flip-flop, flip-flop, flip-flop. It means this. No, it means that. It means this. Because they can't face the reality that what they did was they criminalized the collection or conversion of loan fees into principal at time zero. That is inherent to virtually every loan contract in this country. They are all null and void. The legal societies as a body is technically, morally, and actually responsible for this. It has been repeatedly recognized as morally wrong, as equitably wrong, and as criminally wrong. And what these guys overlooked and what hasn't been discussed in the legal professions, other than the fact that technically the lawyer is breaking the criminal law, is that these are RICO statutes in Canada. They are enterprise crime or racketeering offenses. So every time you convert interest into principal in the form of loan fees, your contract becomes a contract for money laundering. You have literally money laundered under this section 462.31A, actually, and C is counseling by the lawyer to commit an enterprise crime offense, which is itself an enterprise crime offense.